From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Want to see something really scary? Well, you're not alone. Horror movies account for 4 of the top 10 films at the box office this week. Scary zombies and gory ghouls will prowl Utah streets on Halloween night. And in towns throughout the state, the queues for haunted houses consistently wrap around the block. As people and as a culture, we have a fascination with fear, it seems. And today on the program, we're exploring just why we seek out scariness and how our bodies and minds respond to managed anxiety. Plus, a look at Petropolis, a film that focuses on tar sands development in Canada, a business that some environmentalists worry could be coming to Utah. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. It's a Halloween edition today, so how many haunted houses have you gone to so far this year? Do you make your own homemade spook alley, or are you dressing as a gruesome zombie for Halloween? If you think about it, there's a fair bit of scariness embraced by our culture, and today on the program, we're talking about just why we are drawn to the spooky and the gory and the tense in managed ways. Joining me on the show is Mark Rubenfeld. He's a professor and chair of the sociology department at Westminster College. And Dr. Rubenfeld, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Also with us, Ashley Thorne. She's a therapist at Wasatch Family Therapy in Cottonwood Heights. And Ashley, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And you can join our conversation as well, from Psycho to Paranormal Activity 4. Do you have a favorite horror film? What frightening encounters have you had so far this Halloween season? If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Ashley, I want to start with you. When was the last time you were voluntarily scared?
You know, I'm a big fan of horror films myself, so fairly recently, being Halloween and everything, I've been watching a lot of scary movies.
So what is it about the experience that draws you in?
Well, it's kind of interesting. The thing about fear is that there are actually a lot of positive parts to it. We have fear to alert us to danger and make us aware of what's going on. And in that process, we get this rush of hormones, we get adrenaline, and we experience the fight or flight response. If we can then realize that there's no real present danger, that feeling can kind of be a positive thing. And it can, like a lot of people describe it as a rush, and it can be kind of exciting. But again, when it's managed, like you said earlier, when you know there is no real present danger. So when I'm watching a scary movie, I know the guy's not going to come out of the screen and actually get me. So I can experience those pleasurable hormones and rush of feelings without having to ward off any, you know, real danger. So
this is sort of, it sounds like it's embedded in our psyche, this attraction to fear, the excitement that comes with it. Dr. Rubenfeld, what are the cultural factors surrounding fear?
Right, absolutely. It's embedded in our psyche, but it's also embedded in our culture. We have a long cultural history of spooky movies and ghost haunts and amusement park rides into the haunted houses. And if anything, in the last 20, 30 years, we've taken a 2-3 minute amusement park ride through the haunted houses and turned it into the haunted attractions. Now it's a 45 minute to 1 hour entertainment experience that you do. It shifted from something that was geared toward the little kids, Halloween, to the demographic of 18 to 34 year olds, going to the haunted attractions, having a shared bonding experience together, a great date, either a romantic date or a group date, in a scary, exhilarating type setting that is safe comfort. And when it's all done, yes, you experience a flight to life that Ashley talked about, but you enjoy and appreciate life when it's all done.
So what gave the rise of the haunted house? I mean, it's big business. You go to every other corner, it seems, in the Salt Lake Valley, there's a haunted corn maze or a haunted house or some sort of spook alley, and the lines are around the block.
Right. Well, not to bring politics into about welcome to capitalism. There was a money-making venture just waiting there. We had a long time between July 4th and Thanksgiving as holidays. So what can we create to generate a commercial business? We created Halloween. We turned it from a one-day-a-week taking the little kids trick-and-treating to a one-month event that starts the last week in September and goes to the end of October, and generated it into this billion-dollar industry of costumes and parties and dancing. And the prime demographic right now is 18 to 34-year-olds for Halloween, not the little kids. Also, it is the second biggest commercial holiday today after Christmas. And that has only happened in the last 20, 30 years.
The attraction for young people, again, going back to the lines lining up for a haunted house, the demographic does seem to be the teenagers, the young 20-somethings. Is that because self-induced fear is more appealing to the young than to the old, or is it just a marketing ploy? I'll start with you, and then maybe Ashley can jump in.
Not everything in the world is a marketing ploy. We have some choices to do this too, and we embrace and we look for chances to be thrilled, chances to have opportunities for entertainment. And horror and scary and fear is just one form of entertainment that is there. But it's a good form because it is in a controlled setting. It's a little bit different than watching July 4th fireworks, where every fireworks you see is the same. Every haunted attraction is a little bit different. The themes are different. The theatrics are different. The experience are different. The scares are different that they're. And so part of that fear, thrill, is going into this fearful setting and embracing the unknown while still knowing you're going to come out safe. At the end, that is there for this. Having an exhilarating experience and a safer in another way, too. The horror movies that Ashley had mentioned, not everyone is comfortable with the visceral gore and blood of the horror movies. On the other hand, you don't have the misogyny against women. You don't have the violence against women that is typical of some of the slash movies in the setting that is there. It's scary. It's exhilarating. But it's not bloody.
Ashley, tell us about the demographics, old versus young. And, I mean, as we get older, I mean, is there something going on in our psyche that we just don't want to go to the scary places because we've experienced some trauma along the way?
Yeah, I think there is definitely some truth to that. And I think any parent would know and kind of realize that teenagers developmentally tend to be a little more impulsive and not, they don't think things through as much about what the consequences of things are going to be. They don't worry about that quite as much. So they are a little more willing to kind of try these more fear-inducing things, whereas, like you said, adults kind of have had more experiences. They think through what's going to happen, how they're going to feel, and decide whether or not they like that. Now, another part of fear is also that it's part biochemical and part an emotional reaction. So while everyone has pretty much the same biochemical response where we get that fight or flight and kind of that, you know, chills and our heart rate goes up and things like that, different people react different emotionally to that response. So some find it thrilling and exciting while others find it negative and try to avoid it at all costs. So there's also kind of that factor in there as well.
We're talking about Halloween, of course, and about fear and what it is about these safe places that provide a scary experience, why we are drawn to horror films and to haunted houses, especially this time of year. If you'd like to join us, if you've got a favorite haunt or a scary place that you like to indulge in, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or again, send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Ashley, you mentioned when you're watching a horror movie, you know that it's managed. It's, you know, in 2 hours, it's done, and you've got that thrill. I mean, are there... There aren't a lot of plot twists in a horror film. More often than not, the heroes and the heroines, they get out alive. Uh-huh. Is it because it's predictable that we like to go to horror movies because we know that good will overcome evil, that there will be a happy ending.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a big part of it. We do like to see that. I think as a culture, we always like to see the good overcome evil. There are also scary films where there's a twist at the end, maybe, and maybe that doesn't play out completely, but you still kind of get that rush and you still get that reaction and that feeling of, you know, having the adrenaline and getting excited, and then also that relaxing feeling when the film is over. You feel almost invigorated and kind of that relaxing that happens. So I think that's, at least for me, that's the biggest part of it.
Mark Rubenfeld, did you have something to add?
A few things. One is a lot of people do like horror movies, but it's not the most popular genre. It is with young people that are there for this, and a very select group that enjoy the horror movies. But suspense, vampires, zombies, Frankenstein, monster movies, that is an icon of all of our childhoods. That is an icon of the reading. There is a fascination in the culture of the unknown, of the different, of the deviant that is there for this. All of us get a chance to vicariously experience a deviant side that we may not be in our normal day-to-day activities, but what is that dark side? And then see it play out in a film that is there. But films have limitations. As you mentioned, most of the movies have the similar plots that's there, same time frame. The haunted attraction is just taking that movie experience to another level and a different type of environment now. You're
3D.
Dealing with real actors. You're dealing with theatrics. You're dealing with props. You're dealing with pyrotechnics that is there for this. And you don't know where that scare is coming, where that dark corner you're going to be turning with your friends is going to lead, and who's going to pop out, and what that exhilaration is going to be when you feel it, experience it, and then survive it and go, wow, that wow factor.
Hmm. Do we like fear in the moment, or do we like the feeling that we get after the anxiety has cleared up?
Both. The anticipation beforehand, anyone who can imagine when you were a little kid and going on that roller coaster ride and the trip, slow trip up that was there for it, knowing that you're going to have the thrill ride coming down. So the anticipation, the event itself and the surprise, and then the exhilaration masked with and enhanced by relief that we got through this together and we're intact and we had a great experience.
Ashley?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's both. He described it perfectly. There's kind of that anticipation at the beginning of something potentially scary. You're feeling that rush throughout the entire experience. And then at the end, getting to relax and having kind of that rush come out of you is also a good feeling. So, yeah, it's definitely just about the entire experience.
We're talking about the spine-tingling experiences that get your heart racing and your mind spinning, and why we're attracted to fear in limited doses. We're speaking with Dr. Mark Rubenfeld, professor and chair of the sociology department at Westminster College, and Ashley Thorne, a therapist at Wasatch Family Therapy. And we invite you to join us as well. If you'd like to join our Halloween discussion, why do you watch horror films or go to haunted houses? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Haunted houses are big business this time of year, and scary movies are popular year-round. Today on the program, we're having a little bit of fun on this Halloween and asking the question, just why are we drawn to the spooky, to the gory, and to tense situations? We're exploring the sociological and psychological appeal of managed fear with Dr. Mark Rubenfeld, a professor and chair of the sociology department at Westminster College. Also in studio, Ashley Thorne, a therapist at Wasatch Family Therapy in Cottonwood Heights. And if you'd like to join our conversation, what's the scariest thing, the haunted house or a ghost tour or a horror movie that you've seen lately, and why did you willingly stick it out until the very end? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We've been talking a little bit about, you know, why we seek these managed experiences in fear. I'm curious if this response is all biological or is some of it learned behavior. I mean, often we go to a haunted house with a group of friends. We'll watch a horror film in a crowded theater. Mark Rubenfeld, what do you think?
Like everything else in the nature and nurture debate, it's both. It is biological, it's physiological, it is also cultural, and it is also learned from that. From our earliest ages, from the first time a parent scared us or a brother or sister scared us and went boo, and then we all laughed afterwards because we had the thrill of suspense, to the first Halloween party where we went to when we learned about monsters and ghouls and zombies and the supernatural, and our parents explained that this is theatrics, this is a show, this isn't real for this. To the first time you watch Wizard of Oz. And then finally, when we're talking about when we're older, 18 to 34, one thing we've not mentioned yet, the experience is often a good date. You're clinging to someone's hand through it, someone that you like. You're holding on to them for this. And so you're getting the fear, but you're also getting the comfort that you're with somebody that is protective, somebody that you care about. And that relief and exhilaration that we talked about afterwards, if you don't go through it alone, and most people don't, they go through these things in groups or with somebody, is a shared exhilaration that mm-hmm. is there. And that also adds to the fun, the thrill, the enhancement of the experience.
Ashley, can you go deeper into how fear affects us physiologically? I mean, what is going on in our brains when we experience something that's scary?
Well, what happens is obviously there's first some sort of stimulus or perceived threat of some kind. And then our brain kind of does two things simultaneously. There's one part that's kind of referred to as the low road, where it's kind of our take no chances part of our brain that initiates the fight or flight response. Just whether or not there is real danger, we immediately get this rush of hormones where our heart rate goes up, our blood pressure goes up, we may get goosebumps, our muscles tense. Everyone, I think, has felt that at some point. And then the high road part of our brain takes a little more time and kind of views what's going on in context, asks questions like, is there a real threat? What are my clues to that? Are there other possibilities? Was the door slamming open a prospect of the wind? I mean, there is a windstorm outside, or is someone breaking into my house? Asking those kinds of questions. And then so that fight or flight response almost prepares our bodies to then, once our brain processes what's going on, to then take action.
So, okay, if we have this fear feeling, we've figured out that, okay, this is pretend, it's not real, mm-hmm. and yet we still feel those sensations that it is scary. How long before, I mean, a movie's what, 2 hours long, a haunted house, an hour? Mm-hmm. I mean, how long before it's not good for us? I mean, how long can we sustain that kind of fearfulness?
Well, I think when you're talking about, you know, haunted houses, movies, things like that, those would be considered very short term. And you're also kind of having moments throughout those where you calm down. You're getting the fear experience over and over again. And then maybe there's a moment of calm and then another guy jumps out at you. So our bodies can sustain that. If we're in a constant state of fear or worry, which is more anxiety, then... and you're going throughout almost on a day-to-day basis, constantly worrying about things or having just always this worry that there's a potential fear, but not really knowing what it is or not having seen it yet, almost trying to predict the future. That's when it can become unhealthy if it starts to inhibit your life and you're not able to participate in normal, you know, in social functions, or you're really shying away from things you would normally like to experience. At that point is when you want to maybe do things to calm down that fear response and overcome that a little bit.
And Mark Rubenfeld, I guess evolutionarily, this is the way we've developed. We've been able to kind of turn that switch on and off to realize, okay, this is pretend.
Right. Evolutionary, culturally, that is there for this. We do make the differentiation between what is real life and what is fantasy that is there. And in a safe setting, you know, those dark alleys, those dark corners, that walking into something that you know something's going to happen, you're anticipating it, it happens, you enjoy it, it's exhilarating, and that's there. It's fun because you know it's all pretend, you know it's all fantasy. Where it can be not pretend is if you are being scared in real life that is there. You have a stalker after you. You have somebody that is not leaving you alone, and it's not a fantasy, and it's not a controlled setting that is there. Or you have someone that enjoys scaring you, but to the point where they don't stop, and it changes from fun to set a masochism that is there for this. A parent that tickles their child, and at fun, it's fun, 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 and they overdo it and becomes to a point where it's not fun anymore. Mm. Well, the same thing can happen in real life when we try to scare people and exhilarate people. But in a safe, controlled settings, we're able to experience all the things Ashley talked about, all the positive aspects of it, the fantasy, the exhilaration, the what did we learn from this experience when it's over, the appreciation of life that we came through together, and the bonding of the people that we came through together with.
So I'm guessing that if you have experienced real life trauma, something serious, you probably stay away from these fake scary experiences, Ashley?
You may. Again, that part really depends on the person. And depending on what your traumatic situation was, a lot of times, you know, if you've experienced a very specific traumatic experience, then you will usually tend to shy away from things that are very similar that trigger that experience to come up again. But if you are able to kind of work through that too and learn to process what is real, what is fantasy, learn to kind of train yourself to ask those questions, and learn the skills and tools to calm your anxieties, calm your fears, then it becomes a little easier to participate in the more fun aspects of fear.
We're talking about fear, scary stories, haunted houses, horror films, and why we're drawn to these sort of macabre situations, even if they're temporary. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255 if you'd like to join our conversation. Is there part of us, Ashley, that likes to watch goriness? And I'm thinking of, you know, this is kind of the dark side of our psyche, I guess. But, you know, people rubberneck on the freeway to see an accident. What happened? You know, in some disturbing sort of way, we often like to see our enemies fail. Do you think this is part of, you know, our love of horror films and why we keep going to haunted houses?
Well, I think it's a lot to do with the fascination of the unknown, something maybe we haven't seen or experienced before. There's always just this curious side of us. It's part of human nature to want to know more about things that we don't know. Now, if we become completely obsessed and fascinated by, you know, seeing goriness, seeing people hurt, seeing harm, then it can obviously become potentially really dangerous and unhealthy. But I think it's fairly normal for people to see a car accident and have conflicted feelings of, oh no, what happened? You know, feel empathy and sympathy towards those people, but also you kind of can't look away because there is still somewhat of a fascination of what does this look like? What's happening? I don't know what's going on. I need to figure it out.
And I guess that fits in with cultural norms too.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. There are degrees of horror. There are degrees of suspense. There are degrees of scariness. And, you know, people have made an argument. There is some disagreement, but a number of people have made an argument that particularly the slasher movies, the Friday the 13th, the Hostels and stuff, desensitize our culture to the violence because they escalate it so much, because so much of it is geared toward women, because so much of it has the pain and has a fear, but also has a sexual component in it as well that is there for this, that it could be problematic. On it. On the other hand, when we're talking about haunted houses, when we're talking about horror movies and the classic of the vampire movies and the Dracula movies, most of that violence is implied. Most of that suspense is implied. You don't see the real blood, guts splattering that's there, but you get the fear of the person that pops out of the night at you and scares you.
Psycho.
And that's the right, exactly, for this. And that resonates on what people argue is all the healthy attributes for individuals that can do it in that control type of setting and for the culture as well.
Speaking with Dr. Mark Rubenfeld, he's a professor and chair of the sociology department at Westminster College. Also with us, Ashley Thorne, a therapist at Wasatch Family Therapy in Cottonwood Heights. And we're talking about Halloween and fear and managed fear at this time of year, haunted houses, horror films, etc. 801-355-TALK is our number if you'd like to share a scary experience or what keeps you going back to those horror films and scary stories. Let's go to the phones and get our listeners in on the conversation. Suzanne is joining us from Salt Lake City. Susanna, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been listening to the show, and when I was 11, I guess I had been taking a nap, and I got up, and somebody had been watching The Exorcist in the living room, but there was nobody in the living room when I walked in, and so I just sat down, and I was still a little groggy, and I watched some parts of it, and that was not a good thing. And I remember just being, for months, I had nightmares, and I guess somebody had just left the TV on, but that has made for not a very fun mom when it comes to scary movies and things like that, because I always tell my kids, why do you want to disturb your sleep? Don't watch scary movies and things like that. And so my kids never watch scary movies, and I know it's not very fun for them.
How old are
but
your
how
kids?
Much is too much? Like how much? Because that really did. It was disturbing. I think I was too young maybe for watching a show like that. I don't know.
Susanna, it's interesting. Ashley, I mean, how old should you be to? I mean, when developmentally do we figure out that something is pretend, or and we can keep these images out of our heads?
Well, I don't know that we can completely keep the images out of our heads all the time, but I think you do have to be developmentally old enough to understand what's going on. So, middle adolescent age. I had a similar experience when I was young with a Freddy Krueger movie, and I think what she's talking about, one, she was alone, it sounds like, in viewing this show. So she didn't have anyone there, like Dr. Rubenfeld talked about, to kind of comfort her and share the experience with. She didn't probably understand what was going on and couldn't process it. And so it has stayed with her for a long time. It can, in a sense, be somewhat of a traumatic experience that unless you are able to kind of work through and overcome and talk yourself through, it can be disturbing for a really long time. But there are ways to work through some of those anxieties and fears that have happened. I have a blog post going up on our website today called Halloween, A Chance to Face Fear and Anxiety. So she might want to look through that and kind of see some of the tips that are there for calming some of those fears.
I'll put it on our link on our website as well, kcpw.org. Susanna, I mean, how old are your kids now? At what point do you think you'll get over this?
Oh, well, I mean, I know now as an adult, I know there were cameras there, and but I think when I was 11, I didn't really put two and two together, and I mean, that's a big point there, that I didn't have somebody there saying, oh, remember they're acting, and, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But, my kids are 13 and 11, and I still have a big thing, and I think I've instilled enough this isn't good, but I've kind of instilled enough fear in them that now they're like, no, don't watch that, we can't watch that, because
well,
that makes sense.
Susanna, thanks very much for the call, and happy Halloween.
Oh, thank you.
And Dr. Rubenfeld, I mean, the shared experience, I mean, that does sort of reinforce that, you know, this is managed, it's controlled, it's pretend.
We're human beings, we're social animals. We like to share thrills, we like to share experience, we like to share pleasure that is there, something enjoyable that is there for this. And as I said earlier, it's just a fun outing for most people. But again, not for everybody, and I think that's an important point. There are people that are scared of clowns, there are people that are scared of spiders, there are people that are scared of haunted houses, it's there. And for some people, if they get a group of people together, they'll face that fear, confront that fear with the people, and it could be a very healthy experience to go through it. For others, the choice is avoidance, and there's nothing wrong with that choice either. Know what comforts you, know what doesn't comfort you. And horror movies, haunted homes are for many, many people that provide great thrills and joys and pleasures that we talked about. And for others, they would prefer a nice sunny day at the beach.
We're speaking about Halloween and about fear with Dr. Mark Rubenfeld, professor and chair of the sociology department at Westminster College. Also with us, Ashley Thorne, therapist at Wasatch Family Therapy. And Mark and Ashley, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up next, a real-life scary situation for many people. We're talking about tar sands development. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. According to the environmental group Greenpeace, tar sands development in Canada is scarring the land, polluting the air, and using twice the amount of water used by a city of 2 million people. With state officials approving plans for a tar sands project here in Utah, activists worry about a similar fate. And today on the program, we're talking about the issues presented in the Greenpeace film Petropolis. Joining me in studio is Melanie Martin. She's an activist who works with Utah's tar sands resistance and peaceful uprising. And Melanie, good morning. Thanks so much for your time.
Good morning, Jennifer. Thanks for having me here.
Also with us, Spencer Tripp. He's director of communications at Greenpeace Canada. He's producer of the film Petropolis, and he's joining us by phone. And Spencer, thanks so much for your time as well.
Thank you, and good morning.
Utah Tar Sands Resistance is sponsoring a tar sands discussion tonight, October 31st at 6 o'clock here at the City Library, 210 East 400 South in Salt Lake City. And a free screening of the film Petropolis will start at 7 o'clock. And you can join our conversation if you've got questions or comments about tar sands development, the possibility of it coming to Utah, questions about the activity in Canada. Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Spencer, I'll start with you. According to your website, you say that Canada's tar sands are an oil reserve the size of England. It's the world's largest industrial energy project. Exactly what are tar sands?
Well, it's an oil deposit in northern Alberta, which is a prairie province in Canada. And the oil's been there for many, many years, millennia, really. It's just taken this long to really sort of get at the oil because it's been very expensive. So it took a long time for them to actually develop a process to actually extract the oil. But now that we've sort of hit that point and it's now profitable to invest in it because the price of oil is so high, we're seeing massive growth of development in the tar sands area. And it is true that it is an area the size of England, but of course not all of it is under development at this point. It's growing at an exponential rate, but we're not quite there yet.
How much energy is being produced from the tar sands in Canada?
I think it's 1.5 million barrels of oil per day is headed to the U.S., and it's going to a bunch of different places, but it's an awful lot of oil, and they're trying to amp it up more and more, which is why we're seeing more pipelines being discussed, because without those pipelines, they can't actually get the oil out to these markets, but they're certainly investing billions of dollars into the developments that are there.
Melanie Martin, can you describe what we know about how tar sands are being extracted?
We know that they're using a very devastating strip mining process. It scrapes away the land, the forest. Out in eastern Utah, where they're planning to mine, there's very dense forest in some areas. So basically, they're just scraping away all the life and turning it into this barren wasteland of rubble, just like what's happening in Alberta. And they try to tell us that it will be a completely different situation, that they'll rehabilitate the land, but that's just not possible.
Spencer Tripp, the subtitle to the film Petropolis is Aerial Perspectives on the Alberta Tar Sands. I understand much of the footage was filmed from a helicopter flying over tar sands sites. Since this is a radio program, could you describe some of the visuals in this film? What is the landscape? How has tar sands extraction changed the landscape in Alberta?
Yeah, well, you know, at first, you know, we had to go, you know, up into the air to just get a sense of the scale. You know, from the ground, you can't really sort of get that perspective. There's also an issue, of course, of being on the properties of the different oil companies. But once you get into the air, you sort of really get a sense of the scale of the devastation and how big these, you know, open mine pits really are. And, of course, all that wastewater that you mentioned in your introduction, all that wastewater ends up going back into these open mine pits. So, for instance, you know, several of these larger, older open mine pits that have been sort of more fully developed get filled with all this toxic water and are actually visible with the naked eye from space. So they're huge. They, you know, once you're in a helicopter, and we shot at about 1,000 feet because that was where, you know, public airspace began over these, you know, different developments. From 1,000 feet, it was as far as the eye could see. So, you know, you had to actually, you know, move around and go from one big pit to one big, you know, toxic lake to another, you know, big industrial complexes sort of spewing, you know, toxic chemicals into the air. I mean, it is very, it's a very visceral experience, I think, is what we tried to capture in the film.
We're speaking with Spencer Tripp. He is Director of Communications at Greenpeace Canada, producer of the film Petropolis, Aerial Perspectives on the Alberta Tar Sands. Also with us in studio, Melanie Martin, an activist who works with Utah Tar Sands Resistance. Utah Tar Sands Resistance is sponsoring a tar sands discussion tonight at 6 o'clock here at the City Library, 210 East 4th South in Salt Lake City. They are also providing a free screening of the film Petropolis starting at 7 o'clock. If you've got questions about what's going on in Canada in terms of tar sands extraction, you can call us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. I want to play a clip from the film. This is an expert, Dr. Kevin Timoney. Before we hear the clip, Spencer Tripp, maybe you can introduce us to this expert.
Sure. The expert that you're about to play is actually one of a series of different webisodes or clips that aren't actually in the film, but accompany the film as sort of additional information. And that's because Petropolis itself is actually almost a silent film. It really just sort of presents the tar sands to your naked eye and allows you to sort of judge and draw your own conclusions and sort of come to the material. We didn't want to be very sort of preachy about it. We just wanted to let the camera do the work. So Kevin Timoney is a water expert in Alberta, and he's just sort of been very involved in terms of, you know, collecting samples and sort of monitoring the water in the area, because, of course, all these toxic lakes that are there are leaching into the local waterways.
All right. This is an excerpt, webisode from that accompanies the film Petropolis, produced by Greenpeace Canada.
Many, many records indicate chronic and serious levels of sulfur dioxide or hydrogen sulfide or particulates or nitrous oxides in the air with very little or no evidence of anything being done by the government. Very clear evidence that the tailings ponds are leaking, and the government knows that they're leaking and seeping into, causing groundwater plumes of contaminants.
That's from a webisode accompanying the film Petropolis. Spencer Tripp, tell me a little bit about the air emissions, the pollution that accompanies tar sands extraction.
Yeah, I mean, there's you know, we haven't, you know, focused on that as much, but of course, you know, if you're in the area, you know, there's a lot of, you know, particulates and different toxic chemicals that are being spewed out of the local industry there. Now, not all of the oil is being refined in the area. So this is one of the sort of funny things about the tar sands, is that you're actually sort of exporting a lot of the pollution by having the oil, the crude, piped to different places as far away as Texas, and then having it refined there. So you're actually getting a pollution effect that is sort of quite distant from where the oil actually started. But yes, in the area of the tar sands, you know, in Alberta, you know, we're seeing all sorts of different, you know, sulfur and different pollutants that are going out into the atmosphere. You know, flying above the scene there for at 1,000 feet, I mean, you're just sort of struck by, you know, that, oh my God, it smells, you know, just as much at 1,000 feet as it does on the ground, because there is this overpowering sense, smell of sulfur everywhere, which is a byproduct of their process.
Hmm. Why did Greenpeace get involved in this topic? What kind of brought it to your attention, Spencer Tripp?
Well, it's certainly the fastest growing source of greenhouse gas emissions in Canada. So for the Canadian government to get serious about climate change, it has to address the tar sands, and we're certainly very active in that campaign. So it was really from that standpoint, but of course we're also very interested in the local human health effects. People that are, you know, drinking that water downstream, breathing the air, and really, you know, investing and subsidizing an industry that is preventing us from actually switching over to more cleaner, renewable energies. And that's a real problem, you know, in Canada and globally.
Speaking with Spencer Tripp, Director of Communications at Greenpeace Canada and producer of the film Petropolis. Also in studio, Melanie Martin, an activist who works with Utah tar sands resistance. Melanie, what got you involved in this issue?
A lot of it comes down to water for me. Just like in Canada, the Green River and the Colorado River would be polluted with dangerous carcinogens and other substances that cause mutations, birth defects. The same exact problems exist here. And when I learned that the Bureau of Land Management is considering leasing out hundreds of thousands of acres in Utah for tar sands and the very similar oil shale mining, I became very, very concerned about the health of the people in the state and downriver, even in Mexico, and also our water levels. I know that this process uses vast amounts of water, and we just don't have extra water rights to give away.
I understand, though, that the State Water Quality Board okayed this proposal because they say there's no groundwater there on the site to pollute. Melanie?
Well, actually, it's kind of funny that a group of people from our organization were out at the site a couple of weeks ago, and it rained, hailed, snowed on them. They woke up with the ground soggy, and so they experienced quite a bit of water out there. So the DEQ itself has not gone out and been doing the testing. They're relying on company reports, and of course, the company is very biased. Not wanting to claim that there is groundwater present. There's an aquifer below the surface, and water does continue to flow if it has any pathway to flow. So the water would obviously contaminate the aquifer or contaminate the rivers leading out to the Green River. Sorry, contaminate the stream beds, the streams leading out to the Green River and then to the Colorado.
I want to get our callers in on the conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We're speaking with Melanie Martin, who works with Utah Tar Sands Resistance. They're sponsoring a discussion about tar sands development, the prospect of that here in Utah, tonight at 6 o'clock at the City Library, and then they'll be screening the film Petropolis, which starts at 7 o'clock. Petropolis is a film produced by Greenpeace Canada, and we've got Spencer Tripp, the producer of the film, on the line as well. 801-355-TALK is our number. And let's go to Rafael from Salt Lake City. Rafael, hi.
Hi. Melanie started to answer my question. I was just concerned about the water. And I know in Canada that they use a lot of water to do the process there. And in Utah, we have such a shortage of water. I mean, aside from the contamination factor, where are they going to get this water and how much water, you know, are they going to use a different process than they use in Canada?
Melanie, do you have answers to those questions?
As far as where they'll get the water, I've asked scientists or people from the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, where the water would come from, and they've said that they don't have the answers. I don't think that they can say right now, because I believe the water would have to come from agriculture or from people, from tribes, from somebody else who has to pay the price.
What's the experience in Canada, Spencer Tripp? Remind us of the volume that of water that's required for tar sands extraction in Alberta.
Yeah, it's 2 to 3 barrels of water per barrel of oil. So it's an incredible amount of water. And when you think about it, you know, water is such a valuable resource. To waste it on the production of oil is rather incredible. And then the one thing that I wanted to add, too, is, you know, in addition to, you know, where the water comes from, is what do you do with it afterwards? You know, in Canada, they have water cannons being fired around the clock 24/7 to keep wildlife away from these, you know, giant toxic lakes, because they are so toxic that the moment, you know, a bird flies into it or an animal goes up to have a drink, they die. I mean, it is, you know, incredible to think that, you know, you're not just going to have be taking water out of the local aquifers and local water systems, but you're actually going to be having something very deadly, you know, that's left there behind.
Rafael, thanks so much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. We're talking about tar sands in Canada. The extraction process there, the result, according to Greenpeace, is devastation to the landscape. 801-355-TALK if you'd like to join us. Jessica's joining us from Salt Lake City. Jessica, hi.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
You know, I just wanted to maybe speak to the point that you're talking about water, and the company itself, U.S. Oil Sands, is actually saying that they are going to be using water from the direct area to aid in their mining process, which seems completely contradictory and completely at odds with the fact that they're saying that there is no water in the area. It just seems to me an out-and-out lie on their part. I'm just wondering if your guests could speak to that.
Melanie Martin.
Yes, they plan to use water from the Mesa Verde Aquifer, which is directly below the mining area, so it is exactly at odds with what they are saying. Somehow they seem to look at nature in a very compartmentalized way, thinking that what lies below the surface is somehow not connected with what's above, even though an aquifer by nature is recharged by precipitation. Water is not just isolated below the surface in some sort of little pocket that's not connected with the rest of the ecosystem. The company obviously doesn't have a very holistic and accurate view of ecosystems.
Well, clearly we're going to have to do another show with the company's viewpoint. But Jessica, I guess you share Melanie's concern about this, about tar sands development.
Absolutely, I absolutely do. This is a completely destructive process. There is nothing about this that I think anybody in this state should be in favor of. This is going to decimate that area. It's going to be completely irrecoverable. And I mean, so many parts of Utah are unique in the world, and the Uinta Basin and Buttcliffs is one of those unique areas. Not only just the beauty of it, but the life that exists out there that we are putting at danger. It's heartbreaking to think that this is going to be completely and utterly lost.
Jessica, thanks so much for the call. I want to play another short clip from Dr. Kevin Timoney. And here he's talking about the public input in Canada. Let's take a listen, and then, Spencer, I'll get you to respond.
What I did was I filed what's called a routine disclosure request for all of the tar sands companies from as far back as the government had records. There were over 6,000 incidents of air pollution events or leaks of tailings ponds or spills or fires or leaks of freon or spills of sewage, etc. Some cases there may be 3 or 4 or 5 incidents in a given day. And why is the public not aware of this?
I guess that's my question for you, Spencer Tripp. I mean, how are Canadians reacting to the tar sands development in their country?
Well, you know, it's a hard question to answer, I guess, because you know, Greenpeace, I guess, is an influential organization, but we certainly don't have the dollars and reach of you know, all the major oil companies that are in operation there, and a federal government that is, you know, very much in bed with them. So, you know, they're really changing the landscape of Canada and spending millions and millions of dollars to convince Canadians that this is a good thing. Our dollar has really become, you know, tied to the price of a barrel. So the price of oil goes up and the Canadian dollar goes up, and that's just sort of the reality right now. But it's a finite resource, and, you know, I think people want to, you know, look further ahead than, you know, just the construction jobs that are here today and then gone tomorrow. But the whole thing, you know, Jennifer, just really doesn't, you know, make sense to me on many levels. And I think we have to ask ourselves, you know, why are we going to pursue this, pursue oil to the very last drop? In the 1960s, when it was still very, you know, expensive to extract the oil, they wanted to detonate a nuclear bomb underneath the soil to melt it out. Right now, we're spending, you know, 2 to 3 barrels of water per every barrel of oil, and there's talk about building nuclear power plants to be able to fuel the process to provide it enough energy. So can you imagine actually building nuclear power plants to produce another form of energy? I mean, it's madness on a grand scale.
Spencer Tripp, we're going to have to leave it there. Spencer Tripp with Greenpeace Canada, Melanie Martin with Utah Tar Sands Resistance. The film is Petropolis, being screened tonight at 7, a discussion at 6 o'clock here at the City Library. Thanks to you both. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.